We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And now New Galaxy Broadcasting presents Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition, a program addressing the grave challenges to human and citizen rights in America and the rest of the world. How can we, the people of Earth, take back the power and privileges granted to us by God and address so significantly in the Declaration of Independence? Our rights are inalienable, that is, given by God and incapable of being taken away from or given by another. These rights are the basis of liberty, the foundation of all life and happiness. The Coalition of Planetary Empowerment is an organization designed to give its members tools and information to empower them personally, in relationships and in business and employment, but also to give them a voice and the ability to help transform political and corporate governance to support the true needs and desires of people throughout the world. Inalienable and Free focuses on the need for government and corporate business interests to be responsive to the will and desire of their constituents and consumer shareholders. I am the host of Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition. The title of this program is Israel, the Seeds of Statehood. We're talking about events that began in the late 19th and early 20th century, long before Israel actually became a state. Still, owing to geopolitical concerns of the present day, it's important to know about it. Israel is in the news these days, and we've been covering its actions for weeks, particularly in coordination with related actions by the U.S. During this time, the United States opened the Israeli embassy in Jerusalem during the very time while many Palestinians were being killed, slaughtered, if you like, and wounded in Gaza by the Israelis. The United States abruptly dropped out of the Iran nuclear deal after a questionable public demonstration by Netanyahu, basically supported by the Trump administration, which also supported Israel's attack on Iran-based military posts in Syria immediately following the withdrawal. Prior to this, there had been other Israeli attacks on the military targets in Syria by Israel and two attacks by the United States directly on Syrian targets because of alleged chemical attacks by Assad on his own people. These attacks were not authorized by Congress and were carried out without permission of the Security Council. Also, some of these have been questioned as whether or not there really was a chemical attack or if the chemical attack was staged. Considering the brutal massacre in Gaza supported by the Trump administration, there have been so many violent acts that skirt the rule of international and domestic law that it's hard to keep up. Throughout the centuries, people have used scriptures and other types of philosophically or even supposedly scientifically based ideologies to justify their actions against other people of different ethnicities, religions, and ideologies. My response to this and the recent massacre in Gaza is that there is nothing in the world you can draw on to justify these actions. God, the true God who is potentially within all of us, does not sanctify the murder of innocents in the outrageous orders of snipers that led to most of the deaths of the protesters and wounded hundreds and more in Gaza, not to suicide bombers and other terrorist activities that randomly kill civilians in Israel and around the world, not to drone strikes which destroy whole families and other nearby civilians to target an alleged wrongdoer, not to countries which consciously forbid humanitarian aid to the victims of war or disease and destruction due to war, not to the bombings of civilians and other innocents, yes, that too, and also not to the mass murder of populations by biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, and not to the immensely and catastrophic doctrine of mutually assured destruction that targets the entire planet because one country wants to retaliate against another. Sorry, I don't buy the so-called godly foundations of this kind of behavior. Why? Don't certain scriptures and priestly people countenance such destruction in his holy name? Yes, maybe they do. But you cannot find God by words or people who are outside of you. And history, my friends, is so often written by the winners. Each of us now stands alone in a web of comprehensive deception spun by people in the far past and now by dedicated government agencies and media determined to create agendas that justify crimes against humanity, big or small. Now, this is my opinion. To truly find God, you must stand very naked before him. And I don't mean without any clothes, but without taking with you a whole bunch of baggage in terms of beliefs, ideologies, and thoughts provided to you by educational and social institutions, by parents and government teachers, by books, pamphlets, and speeches. If you do bring this baggage, and I must warn you about this, you could very well get something that appears spiritual, even supernatural, but it will be distorted, as the scriptures actually say, through a glass darkly. No person is ever deprived of some kind of spiritual connection if they truly seek it. But to truly or really seek it is not necessarily accomplished with a dead-on commitment to seek the truth. If it's not set out with a dead-end commitment to seek the truth, to use your faith in that possibility, to find some kind of evidentially based reality that does not condemn or destroy the utility of rational thought or conscience in your search. In other words, you need to actually be really straight with God and not bring in a whole lot of assumptions, because God does exist and God can communicate with you. Unfortunately, to quote scripture, but only in light of the platform of truth and conscience that I'm promoting our specific moment in history, many are called, but few are chosen. Why so few? Because so few approach the throne of God, to use a metaphor, without being fully garbed in their religion, ideology, or committed agnosticism. In other words, you have to be open to the truth. The truth is not just, you know, sort of a spiritual thing that someone tells you about. The truth is what is both the intellectual and the spiritual experience of truth. On the analytical side, the truth is evidential, what you see, the facts, the reality. And the truth, when it comes to spiritual truth, is direct. Well, hopefully there are going to be more of us, but the ability or desire to seek the truth in this way is much rarer than anyone seriously interested in the survival of this planet can hope for. But the truth is, I do hope for it. Let me remind you, everybody, this is a talk show. Our number is 888-429-5471. Please keep your questions and comments connected to the theme of the show, which is now Israel, the Seeds of Statehood. Again, the number is 1-888-429-5471. But getting back to the events in Gaza and the dangers for war in Syria and Iran and perhaps other related catastrophes which might at least partially incriminate the United States and Israel, I think it is important not to conflate distorted leadership of a certain ethnicity with the constituents of that ethnicity. I'm speaking now of the Jews in particular. There are commentators now on the internet, some rational, some semi-rational, and some infused with hatred, that note Jewish participation in various conspiracies. Some would suggest that the whole of Judaism is responsible for all the ills of the planet. These people downsized the Holocaust and the pogroms, the inquisitions, and attacks throughout history against the Jewish people. I heard one commentator say how so many countries protect Jews unfairly because everyone else needs to be protected. I agree with that everyone else category, but there's still a lot of anti-Semitism in the world, and rules or not, which exist in certain countries, do not stop the reality of it any more than our laws in the United States against segregation and hate crimes keep the full power of discrimination and its multiple effects from reaching our African-American population. Yes, things are better for them and better for the Jews in general, perhaps, but nonetheless, all this hatred still exists. As I will point out, I am of Jewish extraction, but I do not personally identify with any one religion. What I do identify with is what I call core spirituality, which I consider the essence of all religions and ideologies that postulate the existence of a God harmonious with reason and with truth. But even though I have a kind of universal perspective, I understand the challenges of people who are essentially believers in a certain faith or belief, and I want to protect them. This program is going to dwell on the motivations behind Zionism and to separate some of its rationale from the toxic variants that we see so clearly in Gaza and the Palestinian occupation. Three religions see Jerusalem as a holy city, but for different reasons and for centuries, these people, for one another reason or another, have been at each other's throats. Although I do not necessarily agree with each of their rationales for their separateness from other peoples generated by the identities based on their religious practices, I still believe they represent a level of spirituality that must be protected as long as they can live harmoniously with their neighbors. In other words, I believe in freedom of speech. and freedom of religion and freedom of assembly. And freedom of religion means that people can believe in these type of things, and a Bible or scriptural based religion or other things, as long as they don't hurt other people. I want to protect them. I want to protect their freedom to grow in whatever way they want. There is a book called Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, which was written by Professor Gershom Scholem. It basically tries to show how core Judaism has its roots in mysticism, which some would call cosmic consciousness. To me, his theories are closer to the roots of Jewish teachings, but these same roots exist in Islam, Christianity, and other religions. That core experience, which actually occurs on many levels, is closer to my reality. But those of us who have tasted of this elixir, this wine exalted by Sufis, by Christian and Jewish mystics, and those of us rooted in the core experience, need to care for their brethren. For some of us are making their journey out of necessity from a different place, and we need to allow them for their journey, legally, philosophically, and personally. So for a bit of time, we're going to go backwards in history and explore some of the moments that led to the Jews wishing to return to their homeland. And despite the complexity of the current Israeli-U.S. engagements, much of the conflict lies in the question of the legality of territory occupied by Israel, and this began a long time ago. The March of Return was made by people stripped of their homes and homeland by the creation of the Israeli state, and they have their own story of abuse and anguish. And although I want to speak more of that, right now, I want to explore the bit of the roots of Zionism to see if we can pluck a chord of compassion for those who long for a Jewish homeland. For many, this is also a forgotten story. The Jewish quest for a homeland in this manner began fairly recently, but decades before Hitler raised the Nazi banner. Some say it began with Theodor Herzl, who was a reporter who covered the famous Dreyfus incident, where a Jewish-French officer was accused of spying. His public humiliation set off a wave of anti-Semitism and drove Theodor Herzl, the reporter, to write a book called The Jewish State. Later, the violence he had seen prompted him to create the first Zionist Congress in 1897. There was a great deal of anti-Semitism back then, but the pogroms in Russia probably eclipsed most everything else in the modern world. We make a big deal out of the Jews needing a homeland because of the Nazis, but this is not where Zionism started. And although I'm going to present some historical moments here, there are others out there, and some of them involve those seeking to expand their Zionism with violence and contempt for those who oppose them. But for the moment, we're going to dwell on something else, those truly victimized by anti-Semitism, when it gripped hundreds of thousands of people entirely oblivious of some grand scheme of conquest, which some commentators are talking about today. During the 19th and 20th century, there were many powerful assaults on the Jews. One continuing anti-Semitic activity that eventually ignited anger and distrust throughout the world were the Russian pogroms. The following is an excerpt from the Jewish Virtual History Library for those who don't know about it. Pogrom is a Russian word designating an attack accompanied by destruction, looting of property, murder, and rape perpetuated by one section of the population against another. In modern Russian history, pogroms have been perpetuated against other nations, Armenians, Tatars, etc., or groups of inhabitants like intelligentsia. However, as an international term, the word pogrom is employed in many languages to describe specifically the attacks accompanied by looting and bloodshed against the Jews in Russia. The word designates more particularly the attacks carried out by the Christian population against the Jews between 1881 and 1921, while the civil and military authorities remained neutral and occasionally provided their secret or open support. The pogroms occurred during periods of severe political crisis in the country and were linked to social upheavals and nationalist incitement of Eastern Europe. The Jews of Russia were the victims of three large-scale waves of pogroms, each of which surpassed the preceding in scope and savagery. But since time is limited, we're just going to focus on one incident, quoting again from the Jewish Virtual Library. The second wave of pogroms was connected with the revolutionary agitation in Russia and the First Russian Revolution of 1905. In its struggle against the revolutionary movement, the Russian government gave the reactionary press a free hand to engage in unbridled anti-Jewish incitement in an attempt to divert the anger of the masses against it towards the Jews and to represent the revolutionary movement as the result of Jewish machinations. Monarchist societies such as the Union of Russian People, the Double-Headed Eagle Society, and others, which were referred to by the general name of the Black Hundreds, played a prominent role in the organization. The first results of this incitement were pogroms which occurred in Chisinau during Passover of 1903. In the wake of the wild agitation propagated by the anti-Semitic local newspaper Basarabetz, edited by P. Khrushchev. Let us listen to the Israeli state documentary called The Pillar of Fire, with some original footage from the survivors of this terrible pogrom in 38.
This was during the early years of the reign of Edward VII. In Britain, the age-old idea of the restoration of Israel was much in favor. However, despite all its goodwill, His Majesty's government was incapable of returning the land of Israel to the Jews, as this land was simply not in its possession. This is Chisinau, the city that put on the world's agenda the plight of 8 million Jews in Tsarist Russia. Here was the scene of the first and most notorious pogrom of the 20th century.
I remember that at dusk, groups of young people gathered in the street opposite our house. For some reason, Papa went from window to window and looked outside. After I was put to bed by our nanny, they threw a stone. I heard windows breaking. I asked Nanny what it was, but she just said, "Lie down. Lie down and be quiet. Don't leave your room," and so on. All the windows in our large room were shattered.
The pogrom, which started with the shattering of windows, developed into an all-out attack on homes and shops. Towards evening, the massacre began. Marauders threw children out of upper-story windows, gouged out their victims' eyes, and drove nails into their heads. For 2 days, the police did not intervene, halting the slaughter only on the third day, when the number of deaths had reached 49. Herzl, deeply upset by the pogroms, then convened the 6th Zionist Congress in Basel.
This 6th Zionist Congress had an amazing offer for its members. Let's hear a little further clip from The Pillar of Fire, M39.
There were opening speeches, just as always. There was great tension. We felt that there was something extraordinary in the air. Suddenly, Herzl rose and declared, "I have a great surprise for you.
His Majesty, the King of the British Empire,
His Majesty, the King of the British Empire, sends you a gift. The gift is Uganda." When he returned to his seat, there was unbelievable tension in the hall. Total silence. Not a single voice was heard. Suddenly, it was as if the entire hall was stirred to life. Some people began shouting, "We don't want it, we don't want it," while others screamed, "Yes, we do." It was a great scandal.
The British government's generous offer to establish a Jewish homeland in Africa put the Zionist movement to its most serious test. Many supported Herzl, but others resisted, explaining that the Jewish people cannot build a national home anywhere but in its own beloved land. Herzl was especially perplexed by the reaction of the delegates from Chisinau. Even they, the Jews of the City of Slaughter, rejected the Uganda plan.
school. Lo hevin makara.
He didn't understand what happened.
Lo hevin
makara. He didn't understand at all.
Lo mashu shu lo yachol hayalivloa. Makara.
He just couldn't grasp how such an unfortunate nation, suffering pogroms and denied all rights and privileges, could be offered a country and say no.
Ve'omer lo. והציונים הרוסים התחילו להסביר לו, אנחנו לא...
Russian Zionists began to explain, we don't want just any country. We are Zionists. We want to return to our ancestral homeland.
Well, you know, I don't know how it is for you, but all this is very sad for me. I'll explain more later. But there is a point in my life where I was actively involved in the civil rights movement. So I know that that even when you're repressed or your friends and associates are being repressed, you can make yourself feel better by actually taking a stand. So I'm going to play one of my favorite songs sung by Mahalia Jackson, followed by a little bit of a discussion of how we offer active investors opportunities to work on some of the products that we are in the middle of creating or have created partially, because we do have some really extraordinary things available. So let's play M16 followed by C14. This is Johnny Bluestar, CEO of New Galaxy Enterprises, a media content development company. In addition to serving our freelance writing clients, we have a number of in-house proprietary products that we could use active investors to participate in. Active investors will get appropriate credit for their participation in writing, marketing, or assistance in producing.
These projects are screenplays, TV pilots, and books, some susceptible for further in-house development as film and novel franchises or standalone film, novel, or television series. Many are in various stages of completion, but there are some in an idea stage. Money invested in these projects are for content development and marketing the screenplay, novel, or pilot to appropriate industry venues, including literary or talent agencies, production companies, television, and movie studios. To learn more about New Galaxy, see samples of our work, or talk to us about your project, please go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com and fill out the contact form.
There are a lot of theories out there about the founding of Israel, and I believe some of them are true, including very terrible things that happened to the Palestinians who lost their homeland. Many of these terrible things happened in front of our eyes during the last few weeks. And yes, there seem to be influences that are collectively driving U.S. and American imperialism, and I've indicated a small portion of that in our previous broadcasts. Are some Jews doing bad things now on a global basis, things somehow connected to those striving for a tyrannical world order? Yes, I think possibly yes. But I also see many types of people and nationalities also involved. I don't think it's just the Jews. But yes, there are, the Jewish Zionist imperialists. I don't like to just say Jews, because the whole point of this program, we're not just talking about anyone. We're talking about a specific set of people. But for the purposes of this program, it is important to realize the difference between solely religious-based Zionism and imperialistic Zionism. Herzl, who is surprised that the Jews in his organization refused the homeland of Uganda, wouldn't you like to be offered a country? He was surprised because he was more or less a political Zionist, but not one with imperialistic intent. He seems to have just wanted his ethnic colleagues to have a safe and secure homeland where they could protect themselves. At least he started out that way. Think about it. Thousands of Jews at the time were being killed, maimed, and tortured just because of their religion. Although wealthy Jews with imperialistic intent may have woven their interests into the movement, the majority of these people wanted freedom to live, attain some kind of prosperity for their families, and worship how they wanted without persecution. I am here in the United States as a citizen because of terrible persecutions against my family. In the past, I've spoken about my Polish grandmother on my father's side and how many people were killed in our family in Warsaw, 10 of them, I understand, and concentration camps throughout Poland. But she personally came here before the war. But I'm also here for another reason. My grandfather, also on my father's side, came here specifically from a small town in Russia because of these pogroms. His father, Sri Shikl, was a Talmudic scholar and professionally a bootmaker. I believe his major client was the Tsar's army, but somehow, although I do not know the specific circumstances, one of his sons was kicked in the head by one of the Tsar's army horses. I believe it was an act of intentional cruelty because of my family's religion. At any rate, my grandfather came to the United States and sold apples on the street with his father, the Talmudic scholar. Through some bit of luck, my grandfather, Nathan, became a messenger boy for a stock market company called Hirschfeld & Stern on Wall Street. He somehow managed to move up, not because of some special connection to the powerful and famous, but by hard work, eventually becoming a senior partner in his brokerage. I used to visit the New York Stock Exchange with my father and look down from another floor at the exchange and see his bald head bobbing up and down amidst the frenzy of trading. Oh, yes, there's a third reason. My other grandfather came here from Romania. Marcus actually walked across the continent of Europe to eventually catch a boat to come here. He talked about the badge he had to wear as a child to identify himself as a Jew. Yeah, that was before the Nazis. In case you don't know it, not only was there anti-Semitism all over the place in Europe, but there were also pogroms in many countries. When he was in Romania, he was kind of adopted or befriended by a French legionnaire, and somehow he gave him his last name of Klepper to prevent persecution in Romania, Klepper being a French name. So his name became Marcus Klepper. When he came here, even though his brother became the head of the Romanian society in New York, he refused to speak Romanian. In the beginning, he had to fight for survival on the streets of New York, literally fight. But eventually, step by step, he got into the ladies' clothing wear business. At the end, he owned 4 stores around Times Square. In fact, his unofficial title became the mayor of Times Square. what I'm making the case for here is that I'm not here. I am here because of escaping rabid anti-Semitism. But this place wasn't the perfect refuge because it existed in this country as well. The 1947 Gentleman's Agreement starring Dorothy McGuire and Gregory Peck exposed some of it in film form for the first time. In the film, a writer impersonates a Jewish person and takes on a Jewish name to fulfill an assignment for a magazine editor. Both the book written by Laura Z. Hobson and the movie open the door to acknowledging the deep anti-Semitic prejudices held and exercised by many Americans. Despite a variety of obstacles explained in the next clip, the film won an Oscar for Best Picture of the Year. The following is a clip reviewing that film by the cinematic pack rat. So we'll listen to N40.
And the Oscar goes to...
Practically all the studio heads during the Golden Age of Hollywood were Jewish. Despite this, they were often afraid of broadcasting their heritage to the nation. As immigrants, they wanted to assimilate into American culture. They also didn't want to hurt business in Germany before the Second World War, and didn't want to feel the wrath of American anti-Semitism after it. The only big Hollywood producer and studio executive who wanted to tackle anti-Semitism in the mid-late 1940s was 20th Century Fox's Daryl Zanuck, a Gentile. After he was mistaken for a Jew and denied entrance into the Los Angeles Country Club, Zanuck became so infuriated with the prejudice that he was determined to make a film condemning anti-Semitism. The other Hollywood moguls asked him not to do it for fear of the backlash that may arise. Zanuck ignored them and chose to adapt Lowell Z. Hobson's 1947 novel, Gentleman's Agreement, which was originally serialized in Cosmopolitan magazine in 1946. The story follows newly arrived New York City journalist Philip Green, played by Gregory Peck, as he writes a story on anti-Semitism for his new job at a local magazine. The magazine's publisher, played by Albert Dekker, is passionate about the story. He wants Phil to get to the heart of the issue and find an interesting angle that goes beyond facts and figures. Phil spends weeks racking his brain on how to do this. He's not content finding the answers through the reading of statistics and relaying the experience of others. He wants to find the answers in his own guts, and not somebody else's.
On the coal mine series, I didn't sit in my bedroom and do a lot of research, did I? I didn't go out and tap some poor, grimy guy on the shoulder and make him talk. I got myself a job. I went down in the dark. I slept in a shack. I didn't try to dig into a coal miner's heart. I was a miner. I got it. The lead, the idea, the angle. This is the way. It's the only way. I'll be Jewish. All I got to do is say it. Nobody knows me around here. I can just say it. I can live it myself for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 9 months, no matter how long it takes. Ma is right this time.
Only Phil's mother, played by Anne Revere, his son Tom, played by Dean Stockwell, his childhood friend David Goldman, a Jewish soldier, played by real-life Jew John Garfield, and Kathy, the niece of the publisher, who quickly gets in a romantic relationship with Phil, know he is actually a Gentile. Celeste Holm also stars as the magazine's fashion editor, a role that won her Best Supporting Actress. Kathy, played by Dorothy McGuire, was the one who proposed the story idea to her uncle, but she fears what people will think about her and Phil when they find out he's Jewish. This causes friction between the couple. Phil is adamant that what he's doing is right, and he thinks Kathy's behavior is part of the problem. In the meantime, Phil experiences racism from doctors, hotel owners, and even magazine co-workers. He must fight back against the prejudice and continue with his story if he hopes to bring light to such a prevalent American problem. I applaud Zanuck for taking on a subject that scared everyone else in Hollywood, and for doing it so subtly and three-dimensionally. Director Elia Kazan, who won Best Director for this film, doesn't portray anti-Semites as crazed, foaming-at-the-mouth monsters, but as regular people. Regular people acting like total jerks, mind you, but they feel like racists you would meet in real life, and not fictional boogeymen. Also, it is made clear that vocal and obvious anti-Semites aren't the only issue. Those who stand idly by while racists get away with their acts of prejudice are to blame, too. This is what drives Kathy's story. Kathy thinks she's not anti-Semitic, but she's cautious about letting people believe Phil is Jewish. After Tom is picked on by school kids for being Jewish, Kathy tries to reassure him by saying it's okay because he's not really Jewish.
You've only assured him that he's the most wonderful of all creatures, a white Christian American. You instantly gave him that lovely taste of superiority, the poison that millions of parents drop into the minds of millions of children.
You really do think I'm an anti-Semite?
No, I don't,
you
Kathy.
You do. You've thought it secretly for a long time.
No, it's just that I've come to see that lots of nice people who aren't, people who despise it and detest it and deplore it and protest their own innocence, help it along and then wonder why it grows. People who'd never beat up a Jew or your kikated child. People who think that anti-Semitism is something away off in some dark crackpot place with low-class morons. That's the biggest discovery I've made about this whole business, Kat, the good people. and nice people.
Even other Jews seem leery of showing their true heritage and standing up for themselves. Phil Secretary, played by June Havoc, changed her name from Estelle Walowski to Elaine Wales after her initial job application to the magazine was turned down when using her real name. Elaine is happy to assimilate and sometimes acts as bad as Kathy.
Mr. Green, you don't want things changed around here, do you? Even though you are a writer, and it's different for writers.
Different for writers, how?
Well, I mean, just let them get one wrong one in here, and it'll come out of us. It's no fun being the fall guy for the kikey ones.
Now, look, Miss Wales, we've got to be frank with each other. You have a right to know right now that words like yid and kike and kikey and nigger and coon make me kind of sick no matter who says them.
Even when my father was a lieutenant in a JAG in the Army Air Corps, he and my mother, whose last name was Shulman, were refused to get a room in a motel in Texas because they had Jewish names. I don't know to what degree they experienced things back then, but the Jews were not protected from anti-Semitism even during the war when the Nazis were killing, torturing, and experimenting on them. Still, my family was lucky coming here, but the situation collectively for the Jews back then during Theodor Herzl's time was absolutely terrible. In some way, as every bit as bad as during the Nazi era, they felt they needed a country or at least a place they could call home. These people were subjected to incredible suffering. So whatever problems they've had in the formation of Israel, it was a damn good reason they decided to go there. Oh, let me remind everybody out there, this is a talk show. Our number is 1-888-429-5471. Please keep your questions and comments connected to the theme of this show, which is the seeds of Israel, the seeds of statehood. Again, the number is 1-888-429-5471. Now, we're going to have a commercial from my favorite doctor and a little about the mission of New Galaxy Enterprises.
Dr. Hugo Rodier is a medical doctor trained in nutritional medicine with a special interest in intestinal disorders. You may schedule a consult via Skype or telephone by calling 801-898-3317 or via email by accessing his website, hugorodier.com, hugorodier.com. No insurance accepted, but a form is available to apply for reimbursement from your insurance except for Medicare. Dr. Rodier speaks English, French, and Spanish.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
Lynn the Mystic Healer is with us today with a special report.
Yes, hello, hello. Thank you for your program today. Yeah, it's time for inner peace for world peace in relationship to your program. I just really wanted to put out there because my brothers were Army, Navy, Marines, and I grew up inside the military-industrial complex, and we have internet, cell phones, and language apps to go beyond the all the old divisions of race, religion, and gender now. And I'm hoping that people will go to thepeacealliance.org to get some information there and to really understand the history. There's the Trillionaires Club documentary that really shows way, way, way back the proliferation of violence and warring out of the Roman Empire times. So, you know, after they crucified Jesus and what started happening through the banks. So you might want to, you know, put that in there too, because it's time for to bring in, you know, let's move beyond race, religion, and gender problems and bring in the new, you know, civilization that we can now do that with PBS radio and programs that we have. So the peacealliance.org, the really wonderful group, and Tikkun magazine, Rabbi Lerner, and then another Jewish group that's working for peace besides the Jewish Voice for Peace.org group, I love them, is Kat Saviz, and she and Rabbi Lerner and some other rabbis are together, and it's called spiritualprogressives.org. They're here to help to move beyond the old race, religion, and gender divides. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Johnny, for what you're doing.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Well, getting back to our program, thank you. Lynn is a great help to us. But back before and during World War I, there was a presence of Jews in Palestine, Jews who actually spoke Arabic, but they were not a problem for the Arabs. It's important to remember that many of these lands were under the despotic rule of the Ottoman Empire. The forces behind the Arab revolt were an Englishman named Thomas Edward Lawrence and an Emir Faisal, who supported his efforts to lead the revolt in the field, despite the fact that Thomas Edward Lawrence was a British Army officer. If you saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia, you probably missed the part about how Lawrence tried to bring the Jews to Palestine in cooperation with the Zionist movement led by Haim Weizmann. Yeah, well, you missed it because it wasn't in the movie. And he's still mostly known about the Arab revolt, but he actually played a very important role in that story too. But before we go into it, here's a clip from director David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia, which does give an accurate impression of the very slack British government and military's concern about hiding their true objectives from the Arabs. In other words, they didn't want to let the Arabs know what they were about to do in terms of taking over when the Arab revolt was over. Let's hear it, N41.
So you'll hold down the Turkish Desert Army.
Yes.
With 1,000 Arabs.
1,000 Arabs means 1,000 knives. Delivered anywhere, day or night. It means 1,000 camels. That means 1,000 packs of high explosive and 1,000 crack rifles. We can cross Arabia while Johnny Turk is still turning round. I'll smash his railways. And while he's mending them, I'll smash them somewhere else. In 13 weeks, I can have Arabia in chaos.
You are going back then?
Yes. Of course, I'm going back.
Well, if we can see it, so can the Turk. If he finds he's using 4 divisions to fend off a handful of bandits, he'll withdraw.
He daren't withdraw. Arabia's part of his empire. If he gets out now, he knows he'll never get back again.
I wonder who will.
No one will. Arabia's for the Arabs now. That's what I've told them anyway. That's what they think. That's why they're fighting.
Oh, surely.
They've only one suspicion. We'll let them drive the Turks out and then move in ourselves. I've told them that that's false, that we've no ambitions in Arabia. Have we?
I'm not a politician, thank God. Have we any ambition in Arabia, Dryden?
Difficult question, sir.
I want to know, sir, if I can tell them in your name that we've no ambitions in Arabia.
Certainly.
Well, a little subterfuge. This is one of the reasons that the Arabs and the Jews have so much conflict. There was so much deception involved during this time.
people don't maybe realize that that guy, Faisal, who was in the movie, of course, eventually became the head of Syria. And then there was a little bit of a war with the French and the English, I guess, and he had to leave. And then later on, Faisal became the king of Iraq. Anyway, the following is based on various experts from different original letters written at the time that Lawrence had a tenure in the Arab Bureau. These elements were provided by Jeremy Wilson, the author of Lawrence of Arabia. The earliest of these extracts is from a diary by Aaron Aronson, a Zionist who had an interview with Lawrence early in 1917. He describes Lawrence as overbearing but very well-versed in Palestinian topics. Later in August, he met with him again and had the impression Lawrence was dead set against Jewish Zionists. Yet, yes, at the time, no doubt Lawrence was a powerful ally of the Arabs, but his further efforts at inquiry and inquiring about the Zionist ambition show curiosity and openness, but yes, a desire to protect the interests of the Arabs who might control the area in question if the Allies took back Palestine from the Ottoman Turks. Lawrence was also concerned about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, a secret treaty that divided the future Arab lands between France and Great Britain. This was kind of implied in that little discussion because these people in the movie knew about it. I'm not sure that it's accurate historically, but Lawrence did lie to the Arabs eventually. Lawrence keeping this knowledge from the Arab colleagues was a great source of shame and pain for him, which he tried to correct in the Paris Peace Conference when the war was over. Now, Aronson was one of the heads of the Zionist movement in the area. Here's what Lawrence wrote in a letter to Sir Mark Sykes in September of 1917 regarding the Palestinian Jews who had already lived in Palestine and whom he called the colonist Jews, which were the European Zionists who wanted to move them. Now, Sykes was the same Sykes who was involved with the secret Sykes-Picot Treaty that divided the Arab lands between France and Great Britain. So, this is what Lawrence said. I saw Aronson in Cairo, and he said at once the Jews intended to acquire the land rights of all Palestine from Gaza to Haifa and have practical autonomy therein. Is this acquisition to be by fair purchase or by forced sale and expropriation? The present half-crop peasantry with the old freeholders and under Muslim landlords may be ground down, but they have fixity of tenure. Arabs are usually not employed by Jewish colonies. Do the Jews propose that the complete expulsion of the Arab peasantry or their reduction to a day laborer class? You know how the Arabs cling even to bad land and will realize that while Arab feelings don't matter under Turkish rule, the conditions will be vastly different if there is a new independent and rather cuckoo Arab state north and east and south of the Jewish state. I can see a situation arising in which Jewish influence in European finance might not be sufficient to deter the Arab peasants from refusing to quit or worse. So he had some he had some reservations about it. He did think there was we'll see in a second what he thought of the colonists, the European colonist Zionists. And this comes from a review of a book called Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East by Scott Anderson, the reviewer who is looking at this book, says, his name is Michael Rubner, writes, the Arab revolt began in early June 1916 with Hussein's army expelling the Turks from Mecca and Jeddah. 4 months later, with the Turks still ensconced in Medina, Lawrence was dispatched to the Hejaz to determine how much British military assistance Hussein's forces required to oust the Turks. He arrived at two conclusions. First, the British military presence in Arabia would be held to an absolute minimum in order to assuage Arab fears of a European takeover. Second, only Faisal, Hussein's third oldest son, had the ability to lead a successful revolt. By November 1916, Lawrence was appointed temporary liaison officer to Faisal. During the next 2 years, Lawrence and Faisal's forces were in several battles, evicting Turkish forces from the northern Arabia Peninsula and from the port city of Aqaba. And that battle is depicted in the movie, too. In parallel with the Egyptian expeditionary force that took over Palestine along the Mediterranean course under General Edmund Allenby, Faisal's army marched northward, inflicting defeats on the Turks along the areas east of the Jordan River. Took over Damascus on October 1st, 1918, with Lawrence becoming the temporary de facto ruler of the city. What deprived Faisal and the Arabs of gaining permanent control over Syrian political independence is another sequence of secret events that began almost 3 years ago. The British government decided to abrogate its prior commitments to Hussein in January 1916 when its agent Mark Sykes concluded a secret agreement with François Picot, acting on behalf of the French government. And that's the treaty agreement we were talking about. The accord stipulated a post-war division of the Middle East among the Allies, awarding Iraq to Britain and allocating Syria, including Lebanon, to France. Palestine was to be jointly administered by Britain, France, and Russia. The agreement was initially kept from Hussein and British officials in Cairo. According to Anderson, Lawrence recalled that when he and his colleagues on the Cairo military intelligence staff found out about the Sykes-Picot Treaty, they had a, quote, collective urge to vomit. In early February 1917, Lawrence committed an act of treason by revealing the contents of Sykes-Picot to Faisal. Anderson argues that Lawrence was willing to betray his own government because the Arabs were being encouraged to fight and die in return for meaningless promises that had been traded away. Anderson further speculates that Lawrence was also infuriated by what he regarded as Britain's perfidy. Sykes-Picot destroyed his boyhood fantasies of serving as the liberator of an enslaved people. He did have a little bit of an ego. Anyway, during this time, the new Bolshevik regime in Russia, which was against the war, had reached an armistice with the Central Powers. The attitude of the Bolsheviks towards the Allies led them to publish secret treaties, which included that Sykes-Picot Treaty, a great embarrassment to Lawrence. But perhaps the most serious problem for the Palestinians was the Balfour Declaration. Here's a clip from Al Jazeera on its 70th anniversary. It is titled Balfour Declaration, How 67 Words Changed the Course of Palestinian History. That's on N42.
A man of the British establishment, in 1917, Arthur Balfour was Foreign Secretary. His country fighting the First World War on many fronts, including in what the British called the Holy Land, against the Ottoman Turks, when Balfour issued his fateful declaration.
His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country.
The British government wasn't thinking about Arabs when it made that declaration, is the simple truth. It was thinking about its immediate goals for the war, for the aftermath of the war, about propaganda, about rivalry, and also securing for itself a loyal population in Palestine. The Suez Canal, the route to India, the imperial context is terribly important to understand what was happening back then in 1917.
But for the Arab majority, Balfour's promise, however vague, was a betrayal. In the 20s and 30s, Britain governed Palestine as a League of Nations mandate and discovered that Balfour's declaration had not balanced the demands of Jewish and Palestinian nationalism, it had exacerbated them. By the time the British left, with the foundation of Israel in 1948, they were despised by many on both sides.
With the creation of the State of Israel and the Palestinian Nakba that resulted from that, the consequences are still with us all today, and Palestinians do see a direct link. If you talk to Palestinians, they say the Israeli occupation today, now in its just marked its 50th year, is a direct result of what happened 50 years before that, in 1917.
A gathering in London to mark the centenary.
The Balfour Declaration belongs to a different era, a time when Britain could draw lines on maps and give away territory without consulting the people who live there. Yes, a different era, but one with profound consequences today.
Many Israelis will celebrate this centenary, many Palestinians will mourn it. For Britain, this is an awkward anniversary. Barnaby Phillips, Al Jazeera, London.
We're going to see how deeply Lawrence was involved with everything. Because after the Balfour Declaration, there was the famous Faisal-Weizmann Agreement. The Faisal-Weizmann Agreement, I'm taking a little bit from Wikipedia here, was a January 3rd, 1919 agreement between Emir Faisal, the third son of Hussein, of the short-lived Kingdom of Hejaz, and Chaim Weizmann, a Zionist leader who negotiated the 1917 Balfour Declaration with the British government, signed 2 weeks before the start of the Paris Peace Conference. Together with a letter written by Lawrence in Faisal's name to Felix Frankfurter in March 1919, it was one of two documents used by the Zionist delegation at the peace conference to argue that the Zionist plans for Palestine had prior approval of the Arabs. Felix Frankfurter eventually became a very famous Supreme Court justice anyway, but this was before that. The agreement was presented to Faisal in his room at the Carlton Hotel on the 3rd of January in English, which Faisal could not read, and its contents were explained to Faisal by T. Lawrence as the sole translator. Faisal signed the agreement in the same meeting without consulting his advisors awaiting him in a separate room, but added a caveat in Arabic next to his signature, such that Faisal considered the agreement was conditional on Palestine being within the area of Arab independence. The Zionist organization submitted the agreement to the Paris Peace Conference without the caveat. Well, there's a bit of deception there. I don't know if Lawrence was involved in it. It doesn't seem to me he would be. But at any rate, I mean, in other words, this wouldn't work. He was saying, okay, this would be great to give them a homeland, but they would have to be an independent country. Here's a clip from a documentary called The Pillars of Fire. It features Philip Noel Baker, a former British politician, explaining how a certain conversation converted him to Zionist. I think this is one of the most interesting things that we're going to be hearing today. Let's listen to N43.
And when I got to the lunch on Friday week, who were his other guests but Lawrence of Arabia and the Emir Faisal? And I was converted to Zionism by those two men, Faisal making the speeches and Lawrence of Arabia translating from the Arabic. And the Emir Faisal said to me, of course we want Zionists to come into Palestine. We know what will happen. They'll bring vast sums of American and other capital from abroad. They'll bring in the greatest scientists in the world. All the greatest scientists are Jewish. And the territory of Palestine, now so arid and so much of it a desert, will be transformed. It will become a garden. It will blossom like the rose. We shall borrow their experts. We shall work together. We shall do the same in all the countries which we Arabs have turned into deserts. We shall make them flourish again, as they used to in the past.
Well, it certainly happened, but it didn't happen to the Arabs in the sense of being a place, Palestine being a place where the Jews could live there, but was controlled by the Arabs. So, but there was a lot to what he said, and it really did happen that place did become an incredible event in the world of a place that was desert for so many years, and now it's thriving in so many ways. Okay, so we're gonna look at something interesting here. You see, everybody there. I guess I'm concerned because I hear things on the internet that are really attacking the Jewish people in general. And I would like to play something about a protest that happened on May 16th, 2018. Hundreds of New Yorkers with Jewish Voice for Peace, New York City branch, and Jews Say No gathered to mourn the Palestinians killed by Israeli forces during the Great Return March in Gaza and demand action from New York Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand. Here we go, 44.
Hani Fayez al-Adara.
Yahya Ismail Rajab al-Dakur.
Yusuf Ahmad al-Amawi.
Sari Abu Odeh.
Layla Anwar al-Gandor.
Mahmoud Sadi Rani.
Zayed Mohammed Hassan Omar.
As the child of Holocaust survivors.
Not in my name.
Not in my name.
I can't stand by and say nothing and do nothing.
And I have a message for you. We're going to win. And we're going home.
This program, Inalienable and Free, today, with all its limitations, has told a bit about the events that seeded the geopolitical infrastructure that ultimately led to the creation of the State of Israel. I have dwelt on part of this to show that the Zionist movement was partially a struggle to escape the deadly persecution that always haunted the Jews, but became extremely deadly and immense in scope with the advent of the Russian pogroms and other persecutions around the world. So for those who wish to emphasize the Zionist imperialists who today create a lobby in Washington of Israel, right or wrong, who support the Israeli controlled apartheid of the Palestinian people and the attempt to grasp more territory, and who have tried with success to lobby against the nuclear agreement with Iran, there's more to the story, and that must be taken into account when we speak of the Jews. Lawrence Arabia was a man caught in a web of deception spun by the British government with its own imperialistic agenda. So we will go out after our official goodbye with a short musical memory of Lawrence and that bittersweet Arab revolt with its carnage, incredible victories, and disappointing aftermath. We'll go out now. Thank you. Thanks for joining Dr. Rodier and I on Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition. As we go about developing our new organization, the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment, we hope you will consider the importance of taking part in the electoral processes of your government and asserting the rights you have to vote for the companies you respect and love by casting your ballot as a shareholder or as a consumer with what you buy. We hope soon to make this possible through a social network responsive to your needs to dialogue about your rights as a citizen, but also to be able to effectively act in concert with like-minded colleagues to find representatives of government and business executives who will hear your voice and appreciate your message. See you soon.